Welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Byron Belitzos about the Rancha book and the Lucifer Rebellion. And we are detailing why this is such an important story, how it has shaped our world today. And I know, Byron, that you wanted to talk more about the Staff of 100, as you call it. I know you wanted to kind of break this down for us so that there's no misunderstandings here about what actually happened. So go ahead and detail this story for us, and we'll begin on that point.
This group of 100 beings who incarnated 500,000 years ago, this story is somewhat correlated with the interpretations of the cuneiform tablets by Zechariah Sitchin, who said about 500,000 years ago, these gods from outer space, you know, from planet X or whatever, in Nibiru in his case, the Rancha book does not say they're from this physical planet. It says they're actually from a higher sphere, but he got the timing right at least. So they are the first, what you call the first epical revelation to any planet, every inhabited planet. Once the indigenous beings who've evolved over, hundreds of thousands of years from single cell animals, actually, they evolve just as in Darwinian evolution. And then when humans evolve from the higher apes, then will begins to show itself. And will creatures, as they call them in the Rancha book, these indigenous humans of the planet, at a certain point, they're ready biologically and evolutionarily for the first off-planet revelation. And that's done in the form of teacher beings who are what we might call planetary missionaries who incarnated near the Persian, a place on the Persian Gulf, 500,000 years ago, and they created a city, and that city is a very, very misty designation in Sumerian history. And the Lucifer Rebellion occurs 300,000 years later, after they built up a pretty significant civilization there. And that civilization was teaching very basic skills to the tribes, and then those tribes were moving out and disseminating it throughout the region. And the Lucifer Rebellion, again, this correlates with Sitchin, who says about 200,000 years ago, there was a war in heaven. There was a kind of big combat between among the gods. And indeed, the Rancha book says there was the major part of the celestial administration of the planet went over to the Lucifer Rebellion, the Lucifer teaching, and a minority of these beings held to the original line of what I call the multiverse administration, and those groups were at war all the way down through our history, but predominating were the angelic beings on the dark side.
Now, does the Rancha book say when this occurred?
Yeah, again, it says it occurred about 200,000 years ago. So this rebellion of Lucifer was promulgated by him and by his sort of his lieutenant named Satan, and actually propagated to the heads of planets. And so the administrative head, you might say sort of the general manager of our planet, went over to the Lucifer side. And, you know, the lower, so-called lower angels, you know, couldn't imagine these higher beings making a mistake. So they went over with them, and they went into this new kind of accelerated revolutionary administration, whereas the angels that didn't held forth and actually sort of had their own territory, you might say, in heaven. But they did not predominate. And the first thing that these beings in heaven did, that is the celestial realm around the planet, is that they perverted the original administration of the physical beings who were on Earth at this ancient, very ancient city on the Persian Gulf, which, by the way, is called Dalmatia.
Is this something that they've found archaeologically evidence for?
There's evidence of a later, very, very, very ancient place called Dilmun. So if you just look up D-I-L-M-U-N, you will see that it's believed that there was a very old administration, civilization, a primitive one in that region. But no, there is no evidence of that. However, there is evidence of the second great epical revelation, which we should get into. that is 37,000 years ago. And that also gets perverted by the angelic, the sort of the dark angels from on the dark side. And so it's still, you're still within the aegis of this combat between different factions of the angels. So I'd like to, when you feel the audience is ready, I'd like to talk about the second default, as it's called.
Is there, definitely, let's do that. Is there anything in between significant that that happened? I know there's probably tons and tons of material, but something that stands out to you there.
Yeah, it's to capsulize it is here's what happened. When these beings come to a planet to inaugurate the first era of revelation, that is, of teaching the beings things like numbers, writing, plumbing, farming, and various artisanal skills are taught by these higher beings. These beings, they subsist over eons of time. They are immortal because they bring with them something called the Tree of Life. And the Tree of Life is a real biological entity which is brought down from the heavenly realms. And the Tree of Life, of course, has gone into all sorts of legends, myths, and teachings, including Kabbalah. And it purports to have been a real entity. They feed by eating of the Tree of Life. This tree, actually the leaves of the tree, confer immortality. So there was a group of beings that retained this tree after this revolution and the breakup of the original city. And they went off into an area north of Mesopotamia. And that group, there were several groups, and one of the groups followed someone named Nod. And if you know your Bible well, there's something called the Land of Nod.
Right, yeah.
Which is east of Eden. And I want to fill that in for you. So there's an intermediate history after this rebellion and the collapse of the city and the civilization there in the Persian Gulf. And sort of the next big story is that these descendants of the what we call the rebels, the rebel staff, accumulate in the area around Syria and Turkey, that area, as the Land of Nod. And those are actually the descendants of the rebel staff, these physical beings who mated with the indigenous human beings. So that's the thing I didn't yet indicate.
So this is the Nephilim, pretty much.
That's the Nephilim.
Yeah.
There was a mating that went on, and this goes back 200,000 years ago, where they're actually not supposed to mate, but they decided in the revolutionary regime, they decided to mate in order to propagate their new culture. So they mated, and they created a new race. And this race then accumulated north of that area, and they carried on the traditions of Lucifer and Satan in their culture. And but what we're told in the Rancho book is it evolved far beyond the original teachings into just another culture on the planet. So it was actually a viable culture, and it existed and subsisted for a very long time until this new era that I mentioned that starts 37,000 years ago. And there's also genetic evidence of this that we can get into as well.
Definitely. Let's get into it. The second rebellion, the story ignites, something happens again, obviously, to make this war, I guess, to kind of spark again. Is that correct?
Well, what happens is this, is that there, in a normal planetary evolution process, there is two big things that happen. One is sort of the cultural uplift, which is the first off-planet group that comes in. I mentioned the 100 will come into a planet, and they will teach basic cultural skills, language and mathematics and those sorts of things. The second great revelation to a planet in all cases is a biological upliftment that comes from beings who inject a new DNA elements into the gene pool. And these beings are known as Adam and Eve beings. So every planet, I know this sounds really far out, but every planet will have an Adam and an Eve. And it's at the point where the biological, natural evolution of the planet has reached its apex, and all of the genetic potentials have been expressed, which takes eons of time in any gene pool. It takes a very long time for the genetic potentials to all express themselves. So when that point has been reached, then the higher administration will send these new beings, and they're known as descending sons in each case. They descend from the higher realms to the planetary, to a physical planet. And in this case, Adam and Eve were real beings. I know this sounds so contrary to what New Age people and others would like to hear, but there really was an Adam and Eve, according to this story. And they incarnated here 37,000 years ago. And for this, we do have evidence, which we can get into. And they came into an area off the coast of Cyprus, between Cyprus and Syria, and a new civilization was created there so that they could propagate a race. And this is the source of the legends of the Aryan race.
Interesting. Okay, well, tell us more. Continue.
So our Adam and our Eve were brought here 37,000 years ago, but the prep for that was done by another group that I haven't really gotten into, which were sort of the good guys, the minority group. Are out of this 100 that I mentioned, 60 of them went over to the dark side, so to speak. 40 of them did not. And a small group of them had a piece of this tree of life, and they had immortality, according to this. I know it sounds like a fairy tale, but bear with me. They created their own civilization in an adjacent area near where present-day Lake Van in Turkey. Lake Van in Turkey, near eastern central Turkey. And that is an ancient civilization, and there's a lot of evidence of it. And that group was then contacted and told to create this, set the stage and actually create the venue for a new incarnation. And they selected an area that is now underwater off the coast of Cyprus, and over a very long time actually created a city there. And this is a city that Plato describes in two of his dialogues as Atlantis. And this, if you take the characteristics of Atlantis in Plato's Timaeus, they fit with just about every fact in the Urantia book that is alleged, that Plato calls Atlantis. The Urantia book calls it the Garden of Eden.
Okay, I see. Interesting. Now, tell us if this has anything to do with the Göbekli Tepe or anything like that. I mean, this area around in Turkey at the time seems to be very, very important, and it goes way, way back there in terms of how old some of our civilizations seem to be.
Great. I'm so glad you brought that up. That is one of the validations of the history of the Urantia book. I should say that one of the things the Urantia book will tell you is that its history is revelatory. Its science is not revelatory. And we should get into that later, but the history will be borne out by research and our archaeology. So this civilization or the settlements that we have been discovered near in Turkey, and I'm never able to pronounce it. Please pronounce it again for me.
I think it's Göbekli Tepe.
Göbekli, yeah, Göbekli Tepe. The Urantia book described that settlement in 1955 and tells you all, not all about it, but a lot about it, that is now borne out by the excavations, which go back, I don't think, more than 10 or 15 years. It explains how there could have been such an advanced civilization that predates Egypt, the dynasties in Egypt, by 6,000 years. And what we know about Sumeria predates that by thousands of years. How could that be that they have these advanced monoliths and carvings and other artifacts of religion? And that is indeed a remnant of this civilization I mentioned earlier. And it's far much, much later, like 20,000 years later, or 15,000 years later. So it's not all that directly related, but it shows that there was a high civilization, relatively high civilization in the region And correlates with the Urantia book's prehistory claims.
Now, I don't want to take you off track. We should go back and continue the story and talk more about this, what happens here. But just reiterate this point. This is not standard procedure, then, in other words, what happened here on this planet with all these different groups, with the rebellions and introduction of a new species and everything else. That's what makes this planet so special, Byron?
Yeah, it makes it so special. It makes it so unique, and it makes it such a hazardous place.
Right.
Because you, in a normal planet, I should say, is that you have there's a presence of a physical presence of a higher beings who are incarnate avatar beings throughout the entire history of the planet. So this civilization that was inaugurated in the Persian Gulf area, would still have been there today. It would have been the planetary capital, and the staff of 100 would still be there. They would be immortal beings, and so there would be no doubt in people's minds about their history and about the celestial administration.
But we have not gotten this on this planet. There are so many interruptions, shall we say. There are legends about catastrophe that are, in effect, rebooting civilization. We're losing our memory, in effect, to our history. Is this a plan? Is this the intention? Or is this a mistake?
Yeah, it was a mistake. It was a mistake of it's not a human error. It's an error of the angelic superhuman administration. And we are, in a way, victims. I don't want to promote a victim mentality, but it is, we did not create this crazy history.
Right.
And so this is one way to do your history or your historiography, your philosophy of history, at least in my case, I have as part of this a notion of the fall of man, so to speak, right,
yeah,
from the biblical. But it's a updated postmodern, post-Einstein version of the fall of man, which helps you to understand that, you know, a normal planet doesn't have a threat of, doesn't have Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It doesn't have a new world order where they're enslaving the population with high technology. It just doesn't happen. You don't have genocides on planets like we've had.
Well, that feels comfortable to me to know that it's isolated to this rock far out on the arm of our galaxy.
Yeah, this third rock here. Yes,
right,
is, and but the other side of that is, and this is especially in the newer teachings that I mentioned, is that how much we are lovingly attended to, and how hard they're working to try to reach us, to try to tell us about this history and how difficult it is to get it through. And you can see that with each of these revelations I mentioned so far, that they've defaulted. So what's known as the fourth epical revelation is the incarnation of Jesus. And it too was cut short by his murder. And the Urantia book was, in my personal opinion, was also suppressed. As well, so every time they try to intervene, it gets perverted, it gets co-opted, and these are loving interventions. So the overwhelming picture that I get personally, after 3 decades, is that they're desperately trying to reach us, but they cannot sort of do spectacular things that violate our freedom, our free will, you know, by sort of having a massive flying saucer appearance or something like that.
Okay, but right. Someone on our world is also thwarting these attempts to kind of get us up to speed. In effect, is this the agents of Lucifer? Is it Lucifer who's doing this today?
That my personal opinion is not the Urantia teaching. Is that 9/11, for example, is a prime case of cultural suppression, because the perpetrators had in mind reversing evolution, particularly this kind of a spiritual revolution and political revolution that was really mounting in the 80s and 90s. And as a publisher in the 90s, I was amazed at the outpouring of spiritual titles and throughout the sort of New Age realm. And once 9/11 hit, it really kind of stopped that evolution in its tracks. And that's, as from my point of view, 9/11 was really the perfect way for the dark elites, for the cabal, to stop this evolution and to regain control through mind control and propaganda of the war on terror, et cetera. And that's been the method from day one.
So what does the Rancher book tell us about the shape that this war is taking today? And if, obviously this has not been resolved, far from it. It is still ongoing. There's different factions still fighting. There are probably a lot of people out there siding, if you will, with some of these ideologies without really knowing their origins or the purpose for it as well. But does it say anything about how this will play out? Does it contain prophecy, if you will, in that way?
There's specific things we should get into here. So the case of Lucifer, actually the legal case of Lucifer, was taken up in the heavenly courts. Again, this may sound strange, but there are heavenly courts where legal cases are taken. And this is the case known as Gabriel. That's the angel Gabriel. The chief administrator of the local universe is known as Gabriel. His legal case against Lucifer, and that case was up in. Remember, I mentioned the Ancients of Days at the center of the galaxy cluster, who are the chief administrators of all space time. They do the law cases, the highest law cases, and this case was submitted quite a long time ago, with the evidence of Lucifer's wrongdoing. And it said that it will adjudicate soon in the Urantia book. So the Urantia mainstream people believe that it's not yet been settled. The case has not been adjudicated. But these new supplemental teachings that I have published indicate that it has been settled. And these are the apocryphal transmissions. And they state in many cities, many locations, many channelers have stated that in the mid-80s, the case was settled. So the case of Lucifer and Satan versus Gabriel was adjudicated in 1985. And so as far as the so-called heavenly rebellion, legally speaking, it was settled. And the thousands, actually millions of angels that went over to the Lucifer side, they were part of this settlement. They were adjudicated. Mm-hmm. So a judgment was handed down. It's complicated, not easy to summarize. But a judgment, according to this minority teaching in the Urantia movement, has been issued. And it tells you what happens in that case to these beings. These beings, you know, who, remember, they've wreaked havoc on 37 planets. Recall that I mentioned that only 37 planets in the local system went over to the side of Lucifer. So this affects all 37 planets. The millions and millions of beings, they are under a judgment, and the judgment states very generally that they can be rehabilitated if they will accept the rehabilitation. But if they do not accept it, then they are free to choose to extinguish their own extinguishment. So the controversial teaching that I have been publishing for some years now is that it has been settled, and Lucifer and Satan and the chief elite group of angels decided to choose their own extinction rather than recant. But we're told that the cleanup and the mop up, so to speak, of this thing takes a very long time, because you cannot... is in human culture, you cannot incarcerate celestial beings. They have to agree. Well, you can incarcerate them, but you cannot execute them. They have to agree to everything. So that's, they use persuasion in all cases. And so in the case of Lucifer and Satan, they fully chose to their own execution. They are not executed against their will.
Instead of... accepting the order as it exists, I guess, then?
Yeah, they would have to recant. They would have to recant and accept the teaching that actually God does exist, and that there's a better way for evolution to take place than their plan, and that the multiverse administration should manage these planets instead of them, right?
It's a somewhat complex bureaucracy, it sounds like, as well up here.
It really sounds like, and a lot of the critics of the Rancho book say it's this huge bureaucracy and all. But if you study it for a long time, you begin to see that it has incredible economy. It's incredible because it is a highly sustainable system, because they generated trillions of successful planets. And you have to power these planets with all sorts of resources, physical, biological, cultural, spiritual. I mean, this is an incredible, beyond measure in the ability to create sustainability. And, you know, we have here a totally unsustainable planet. But other planets have the reverse. They're highly sustainable because of the way the planetary administration has figured this out on billions of other planets and how it actually works.
But they have also, in those cases, then they have also then... You talked about the original kind of city where it's been sustained for a long time. The life that has arisen on those planets still have a connection with the source, if you will, of those who planted it there, pretty much. Meaning that there's not this gap that we have. There's not this disconnection there as we have. So in one regard, it's somewhat understandable, I guess, if I can put it that way. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that is really a tragic thing to contemplate. Imagine this is a science fiction story, that you know, on a normal planet you would have visible your 100 incarnate avatars who've been teaching for, in our case, 500,000 years, and if you want to find out what the cosmic story is all about, you just travel there and go to the universities of revealed religion. And you get the full story, and you're not going to run around being an existentialist or a nihilist or a punk rocker who believes there's no meaning in the universe.
Right.
You might have a lot of range for error and experimentation, but not the wide range that leads to the kind of criminal activity that you see on this planet.
So what's your take, and we can talk about if there's anything mentioned of this in the Rancho book as well, or what some other parts of the community, if we can call it that, thinks about this, but is there a reason, a deeper meaning to why this happened to our planet and to our race? Is there a bigger lesson in this? I for one usually don't think that it's just a mistake and that's it. There's always a bigger meaning, a purpose behind it. What do you think?
Well, that's interesting you ask, because there's an author, I think the most exciting writer now in the Urantia movement. His name is Timothy Wiley, who you really ought to interview, W-Y-L-L-I-E. And his books, published by Inner Traditions, talk about this very question, because he is of the view and has long been of the view that they built into the celestial hierarchy a weak spot. And that weak spot is at the level that Lucifer is in the administration. It's fairly far down in the administration. So those who are higher up can really see how this stuff works, but at lower levels, they really can't quite see it. And they built this in on purpose, because if something can break, then you can learn new lessons from the rebuilding of it.
Yeah.
And so when you have aberrations like this, the harvest of wisdom and of lessons about evolution is much, much greater. And there's a whole advanced teaching in the Urantia book that escapes many people about this, that we are actually in a very beneficial position here on planet Urantia, that we have experienced being way on the far outer edges of danger and hazardous planetary existence, such that we become envied by humans on other planets. When they find out about us, they actually volunteer in these advanced planets to come here and witness this, to see how we work it out, without having any visible planetary teachers? How do they do it? How do you guys work this out without having any idea really what the big story is? Well, you do it by living by your wits. And it's, you know, we're much more streetwise as a planet, so to speak. And so in the afterlife, and the Ranch book has a huge teaching on the afterlife. In the afterlife, people that ascend from this planet are given very special assignments that require very hardy battle-tested souls. There's all sorts of adventures that we have that are selected for us, because we can go, you know, without being able to see any visible signs of the higher truth. We go by faith. So the upside of this whole thing, and what makes me proud to be a Urantian, so to speak, is that you do gain a kind of super wisdom, because you have to draw from your own inner resources far more on a rebellion planet.
Oh, sure. Now, what does the book say about us in terms of coming back? And do we do that to the same planet, or are we effectively, stuck, if you will? Then we can view it that way, right? That we don't go off to another world all of a sudden where things are more serene, perhaps, but we actually have a purpose and tied to the planet. Is that how it works? Or what does the book say about that?
One of the reasons that New Age folks don't tend to like the Urantia book is it actually is a critique of the reincarnation cosmology. The Urantia book is an ascension cosmology. So the after death, one does not return to a new body here, but you graduate to a higher sphere, to the heavenly realms. Now, there is a kind of reincarnation, but not of the soul. And it's just an arcane subject, not quite worth getting into today. So in general, where we're going is we're resurrecting at the next highest level, sort of a metaphysical planet. It's actually a sphere. And we continue to do that through our eternal life. You're moving upwards and into that central universe that I mentioned at the top of the show. But you're looking back on your life here. And you've had a very rugged time down on planet Earth, and everybody knows you for that. And so in answer to your question, yes, it's much more serene in the afterlife than it was down here. It's much more orderly, much more spiritual. There's not, you know, atom bombs and genocide. and you're meeting people that are incoming from other planets, and they're coming into their afterlife, and they don't have as dramatic a story as we do. And they love to hear our stories, we're told.
Always drawn to drama, aren't we? The every single living thing or sentient being, in a way, they want to have, as a Greek tragedy, they want to have maybe not murder and mayhem, but darn close to it, right?
Well, certainly on this planet, we seem to love drama. Yeah. And drama was introduced to us by our celestial superiors. And so no wonder we have such great opera and all the rest.
So the administrative forces on this world that still is doing the bidding of Lucifer, if we kind of adopt what you said previously about that being resolved pretty much, how do you see that this is going to play itself out? We still have many issues here today in the world. As you said, 9/11 then even happened after the fact that this had been resolved, meaning that the chain of command here, the turning this ship takes a long time, so to speak. So when will things begin to resolve, do you think, on this level?
Oh, it's going to take a long time because the dark side, the planetary cabal, I believe, again, this is my personal interpretation, these are bloodlines, Illuminati bloodlines that go back to the original rebellious staff hundreds of thousands of years ago. So they really have a monopoly on a lot of resources. And so it's going to take a lot to break them. And so they may not have the off-planet input, you know, as David Icke would say, you know, that off-planet entities are giving them energy, which is literally the case, although they're not literally reptilian. They no longer have access to that, according to what I understand. Mm. But there's still the residual field effect, right? So the morphic field, or whatever you want to call it, field effect of the Lucifer rebellion is still here. Of course, it's countering that is the field effect of all the spiritual goodness in our history as well. So we sort of have competing fields, but they're still pulling from that field. But their field is reducing. But one way to refuel the dark side is to have false flag operations like 9/11 or Sandy Hook.
Yep.
And you generate that same energy of fear, terror, paranoia, and literally these are real energies that really are resident as field effect. So as long as they can continue to do these things and these operations, they will be able to feed from that and use that for mind control. So, you know, now we have a little bit that scales are tipped because the off-planet assistance is no longer there. But on-planet, they still have a lot of resources, as you know, and they're liable to continue to do this. Where finally, I should add that in the new incursion of celestial help that I mentioned, it's called the Correcting Time. It's also called the Teaching Mission. It's called the Teaching Mission. It's specifically the mission of teaching the Urantia people these specifics I've been giving you in recent years. They have indicated that sort of the Calvary is coming over the hill, so to speak, because they've sent a massive new wave of celestial help from all around the universe to get us through this current dire sustainability crisis. And for a lot of reasons, this planet is the focus of all over the local universe, because this is the place where Jesus incarnated. And it's a special planet for that reason. And I haven't really emphasized that enough, but that's a central teaching in the Urantia book. This is a planet of great sentimental value throughout the local universe, because this is the only place that the local universe creator incarnated. And so they're going to make sure we pull through.
Let me ask you this, see if I can formulate this in a coherent way. When you're talking about Lucifer basically agreeing to him, being exterminated, taken out in a way, I think about this in a more suspicious of it, I guess. My question is then, why would he do that? And so let me bring another story into it. In the Lord of the Rings universe, we have an entity like Sauron, for example. He physically died at some point in this story, universe story, but it's his spirit that leads to the three later books of the series of the Lord of the Rings, where basically he still managed to influence other beings to basically do the bidding for him. And so my question is, could it be that Lucifer's spirit is strong enough to actually take a new shape, if I can put it that way? Like, this is an archetypal energy, and it could actually find new grounding on a planet like this that is so deep down into the travesty, if you will.
I think that's exactly spot on. I mean, not that there would necessarily be an antichrist, who would literally be a person that would incarnate. But again, looking at 9/11, 9/11 was a very small group of people who were definitely incarnating the worst features of the Lucifer Rebellion and representing that archetype of consciously murdering, kind of a minor genocide with an agenda of mind control. I mean, that is flat out a new incarnation of Lucifer and Satan.
Yeah.
So, yes. And so, again, it is this drama of those who really, some don't really understand any of this history. They are just into this kind of mass manipulation for their own profit. But I believe at the core of that is an occult group of practitioners who still draw from these residual energies of the Lucifer Rebellion.
Can this be broken in any way, according to you?
According to any spiritual teaching, right? I mean, you break the field effect of so-called evil through prayer, you know, through worship of the true God, through loving service, in wherein you create a new field effect. You bring in the Holy Spirit, if you will, which is which heals and absorbs these negative energies. And you can see it happen in healings. You can see it happen in communities where there are incarnations of the Holy Spirit that heals entire, you know, groups and even countries. So that's the spiritual work that we're all doing. You know, political work, like, you know, exposing false flag operations, that's spiritual work. That's exposing this and bring light upon it. So, you know, this is the great work. And the Urantia Book's benefit is that it provides a longer perspective and a deeper theological understanding of that. But it's basically, I think we've all arrived at the same place, which is there is this dark side that that is rising up, and that we have to use all the tools we have to not so much to fight it, but to just create an entirely new civilization.
Is there something genetic in us as well? Is there that literally is a physical part of us, since there seemed to have been genetic manipulation going on at some point in our prehistory?
There's an awful lot on genetics in the Urantia Book that we've not covered. I only briefly mentioned that Adam and Eve, the so-called Adam and Eve incarnation here, they were injecting a new aspect of genetics into the gene pool, and that was aborted, that mission. And so we would actually have, they succeeded for 500 years until they defaulted, but they would still be present on the planet right now. And they would have created a race of beings that would have by now intermarried throughout the entire planet, upstepping the genetics of all races on planet Earth. And as to a diabolical splicing of other genetics, it's been talked about quite a bit by many thinkers and writers. Yes, that was in the breeding of the race called the Nodites. Remember, I mentioned that they were the group that were from the Nephilim that were propagated after the fall of the original staff of 100. Mm-hmm. They were able to propagate and create this race called the Nodites, which I personally interpret as being the origin of the Illuminati bloodlines. But you know, and this is a superior genetic inheritance, and but it's very, very, very much diluted from those distant times. So there isn't anything in the teachings that I'm working with about any recent genetic interventions. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly aware that there's many that say that there's extraterrestrial hybrids. That's not covered in the Urantia Book.
Hmm. Okay. Now, previously, Byron, you said that history is revelatory, but the science is not. Tell us more about what you mean with this.
It's important to get across this, that the Urantia Book is it's really like a great triad of principles. Having to do with science, philosophy, and religion. And the science, what they're doing philosophically is they're trying to say this triad always must come together, that there's going to be a scientific component to any religion, in the sense that your religion implies a science and a cosmology. And so the Urantia Book provides a very advanced science that is commensurate with the spiritual teaching. So you can think of it as kind of a post-Einsteinian science. So we can have a postmodern spirituality. So you couldn't have a postmodern spirituality and have a flat Earth cosmology.
Right.
So it gives a very interesting, very advanced and very plausible, highly advanced cosmology. But the cosmology is not inspired. It's a scaffolding that allows you to envision a much, much bigger God, a much, much bigger universe, much more much more intricate evolution. But it's not revelatory, as in it'll stand on the record of ages, because they're not permitted to supersede our own efforts to make scientific discoveries. That being said, there are many scientific statements in the Urantia book which are prophetic nonetheless, but not all of them are. Chief among them is, as far as I know, this is the first text to clearly describe free energy, that is, the quantum vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
It's really remarkable. It's the first text to describe plate tectonics by 20 years. And the notion of the Pangaea, the original big continent, supercontinent, that then drifted apart, created all the continents, which we now know is the case, was absolutely not known. It had been theorized, but it was very, very marginal when the Urantia book came through. It was only in the 60s, especially the 70s, that plate tectonics and continental drift was accepted. And so the Urantia book, by the way, the downloads that constitute the science part of the Urantia book were done by 1935.
Mm-hmm.
So it predates that theory by, decades. And there's many other things. I can catalog them for you quickly if you like.
I'm very curious about hearing a little bit more about what the book says about free energy. Can you encapsulate that for us a little bit?
Yeah, it's a little bit over my head. There are parts of the Urantia book that, 30 years later, I'm still trying to get. But there's a whole chapter on energy. And if you have an interest in physics, read it. Because basically it says that space itself has potency. They call it space potency. And space has resonant within it almost nearly infinite energy. And the way galaxies are created is that there are beings that know how to tap space and to create a kind of vortex. And the vortex causes the energies of subspace to manifest in space. So out of the quantum vacuum, so to speak, energy and particles come forth into a vortex. And these are huge, and they create these huge, huge nebulas, which begin to rotate, and then suns are thrown off, and then galaxies are created. So, entire galaxies actually originate from the quantum vacuum. So it's a way of saying that all energy in space-time comes from this realm beyond space-time. So all advanced civilizations have learned how to tap that quantum field, the quantum plenum. And so this section tells you about it. And the new transmissions of the Correcting Time, the teaching mission, have quite a bit of stuff, because people have been asking the Celestials, well, tell us about this free energy. And they say, yes, indeed, this is real. This is on other planets, it's used. It's a dangerous thing on your planet because you're a backward planet. But indeed, this is how space travel occurs, and this is how advanced planets power their energy systems. So it's a pretty neat aspect of the Urantia book. But the physics that describes that in the Urantia book is not a revealed physics. It's not perfect, but it's far ahead of anything existing today.
Interesting. Yeah, there's. I mean, that's a major part of our issue, of our problem, is the dependency that we have on the energy sources that we've, that we've been given pretty much at this stage, and what's been chosen to be the only energy sources. I always find it's very interesting when we have this idea that we're very, everyone is thinking now that we're in a position where we have to conserve the energy all the time, and because of faulty in that regard environmental propaganda, we're told that we basically can't use any energy anymore, yet if we look out there in the universe, it is an abundance of energy. It is just more than we ever could imagine, even, and yet we are kind of isolated on this little blue ball, and we don't know how to tap into it or access it. It's really frustrating. It's kind of weird and funny to watch it, really.
Yeah, this is just another one of the ironies of life on this planet, because I'm sure you know, Henrik, that many inventors have, Tesla, et cetera, have discovered this this fact, and it's been suppressed by the cabal, and instead, fossil fuel is substituted, and that gives you the pretext for controlling the population.
Yeah.
On the other side is this, that there's a sense in which our population really cannot be trusted with this energy as well, because we are so mind controlled in the first place. We're so prone to warfare in the first place. So we do really need to convert, but we need to have a spiritual revolution along with it.
There needs to be a change in our mindset and our basically relationship to each other before we can get access to this free energy, because I've said that for a long time. I mean, certainly if it is in the hands of the black ops crowd, it's by no means in good hands. So don't get me wrong. But at the same time, if it was handed out freely, there would be, I think, a lot of people who would misuse it, no doubt about that.
And probably the black ops crowd is using it right now for, as weaponized, or has already weaponized it in various ways.
Yeah.
That could be a subject for a whole other show.
Indeed. Now, I know there's so much more to the book. Of course, there's a whole section on Jesus and the life of him, and you know, the validity of that story and everything else. And that's a major other idea that we might choose for another time. But is there anything else about the book? Some major things that we haven't mentioned that you feel you would want to just briefly talk about, so people know kind of a little sample of what they would get if they go and read the book and discover more about it?
I guess I would want to add just a bit more about the life of Jesus according to the Rancho book, if you will.
Sure, go ahead.
You have a great teacher from Sweden named Emanuel Swedenborg.
Sure, yeah.
Swedenborg, as you may know, his theology is that the Christian teaching of the atonement doctrine is a perverse theology, and the idea of a blood atonement of Christ is rejected, in Swedenborg churches. I mean, they're still around. And that particular teaching is one that's targeted, especially by the Urantia book, to say that Jesus was not present here to be a sacrifice. And so the whole tragedy of the Christian church going off on this strange kind of primitive doctrine of blood atonement really was a horrible situation, because the teachings of Jesus are about the golden rule. It's about ethics. It's about forgiveness and mercy. It's not about that he came here to sacrifice himself in order to ransom God's favor. And that really is the core teaching of basic Christianity, is this guy, this man died for our sins. And that substitute, and again, it's probably an operation of the dark side, that they got this thing substituted for the core teaching, the reason he incarnated, which was to teach basic ethics and a basic picture of the universe as a loving and friendly universe. Instead, you're diverted into this other. So it's a real core thing of the Urantia book. It's in what's known as part four of the Urantia book, the complete biography.
Sorry to interrupt that, but
sure.
I've always been interested in why it is that God demands, if you will, then a sacrifice, Jesus. Someone needs to be sacrificed, in this case, Jesus specifically. Does the Rancho book give like a reason for why that is the current story, why that is? I'm always trying to find some point of reason in that idea. It's like, why is sacrifice? What's so important with that?
Well, on the one hand, if you look at the times that he lived, the teachings of the Mithraism, of course, and especially the Hebrews, believed in the efficacy of blood sacrifice.
Yep.
And so it's not a surprise that Paul, especially St. Paul, seized upon that myth to gain the attention of the pagans and to say, well, okay, this is the final sacrifice. And that has a dramatic appeal. So sacrifice is a valid idea, but this is the final one. You don't have to do it anymore. You just have to believe in this final sacrifice, and then you'll be saved. So Paul is criticized, you know, the Ranch book is ambivalent about Paul. It says he was a brilliant teacher, an incredible disseminator, but he perverted the basic idea and used this as kind of a propaganda tool to get the pagans and the Hebrews to come over to the Christian cult. And so there's a real logic in thinking. It's like good advertising, you know, speak to what the audience's prejudice is. But, you know, it really does pervert the whole thing. And, you know, probably it was just something he was doing as an expedient. But it was seized upon by letter generations and really, you know, probably guided by dark forces, in my humble opinion.
Yeah.
And used to, you know, used to whip the population into shape with the idea that, you know, sinners have to believe in this. And if you don't, you know, you've got hell to pay. So it just becomes another mind control mechanism. What a perversion! What a grand perversion of a very high teaching, and yet another aspect of the tragedy of our planet.
Oh, indeed. I mean, religion has to be one of the most effective mind control, you know, programs of forever. I guess I don't know what else would top that basically at this stage. But do you feel that there are, I mean, the Rancho book is very much still in kind of in a religious context. It's wrapped inside of the Christian message. It's updated that, and therefore again, my point is to go back to that idea. Is it there to basically simply create a new religion? Is there any danger in that? That it's just a continuation, if you will, of some of the issues that we've already seen with religion. What's your take on that?
Well, because it provides, you know, just another facet of this, since you asked for some other things we haven't talked about. It is a very thorough critique of religion, that is, the cultism of religion, the narrowness and the fundamentalism of it, and the need for priesthood, and the need for dogma. All of that is critiqued kind of ruthlessly in the Urantia book. So it's very hard for a Urantia believer to create a church because of that, or to try to adopt a priesthood. And, you know, people have tried it. In fact, a group local to me tried this, and I assisted them. They tried to do a very, very purified version of this. And it's very hard to do, because when you sit down and read the Rancho book, it says, no, this is all about the individual. It's about your personal relationship with the divine. It's about these loving relationships with these higher forces and beings. And you don't need a mediator. You don't need a structure. But that said, yeah, you need to socialize with other people that believe this and form communities. But it's really it kind of comes down to like a Quaker model, where there's really no priesthood. There's just groups that have a worshipful, meditative relationship together with the divine, without the need for symbols and rituals and dogmas and priests. And so it's not really creating, it's creating a postmodern spiritual religion without the trappings.
I see. Okay. And but there's also, on top of that, then there's no, this is not to appeal to people who are sitting around and waiting for ET or other, you know, beings out there to come and save us or help us, pretty much.
Well, I guess there is one more part that we should, before we close, Henrik, in this regard. And you've just done a masterful job of helping me bring out these different facets. And this is the new teaching, the new prophecy, quite controversial, but it's been stated over and over and over again in many places, that they are prepping a new incarnation, a new avatar. And this is a whole different facet. This states that there is a time in the history of any planet where you have a new dispensation to inaugurate in the postmodern era, and you kind of terminate the age, and you kind of put an end to the civilization of the past, and you inaugurate a future civilization. So this is done with a new avatar. They don't use that term, but I'll use it. And we're told that a new being will incarnate soon, and when they say soon, it's like a generation or two, and this will be in the midst of the sustainability crisis, which is already very dire. And in this particular teaching, the sustainability crisis is really beyond the tipping point, and there will be a massive event of environmental disaster, including population die-off. And it's in connection with that that a reboot will be hit, so to speak, and there will be a new staff of incarnate beings. But it will be, and I mentioned the staff of 100, that incarnated a long time ago. Hmm. It'll be like that, and there will be a visible, very, very high being at the heart of that. And in our case, it's all very ad hoc. Hmm. It's ad hoc. It's going to map itself into the needs of the planet. Mm-hmm. And they actually keep saying, well, we've changed the plan. and now it's going to be like this. So these are apocryphal transmissions, and the new book that I put out has a section on this. It's known as The Magisterial Mission.
And the title for this book is what?
It's called The Adventure of Being Human. The Adventure of Being Human is available worldwide, and only in English. And it is the new teachings based on the Rancho book, and it has a section on this new mission. It's brief. But I'm soon to come out with a whole book on this mission in about 3 months.
Okay, interesting. And so these updated versions, is that something that have come through you or who did this come through?
I didn't get to get into that, but it is after this adjudication I mentioned that occurred in the mid-1980s. It's a whole subject here, but the planet was in quarantine. I didn't use that term until the adjudication of the Lucifer and Satanic Rebellion. After the quarantine was lifted, then you could have much more proficient contact with the angelic hierarchy. And so there has been a huge upsurge of contact throughout the world and throughout many religions and languages with higher beings, including extraterrestrials, since that time. And within the Urantia domain, there have been about 100 locations, Urantia students have been contacted by these beings. And it was very out of the blue, and it really took off in the early 90s. And I was in a group that received these teachings out of the blue. And they basically contact people and they channel. But they use the Urantia book as the reference.
Hmm.
And that material is gathered in a database called the TM Archives, tmarchives.com. And there's 50,000 pages, 5,000 sessions or so. This is a lot. This is the biggest channeling phenomenon in the history of religion.
Hmm.
And so I don't think I made it clear that I'm the primary publisher of that material in book form. The book just mentioned is the fifth in my series that come from these supplemental teachings known as the teaching mission, which is a subset of the correcting time. So that's the additional material. And within that community has been the prophecy of the coming of these new incarnate avatars.
Very interesting.
And so, Henrik, I have never put all this stuff in one radio show before. It's thanks to you I've been able to put that whole thing out. But that is in this new stuff, and it's controversial material. It's really, really fun and interesting reading, I can tell you that.
Yeah, sure. Sounds like it. Now, we can close with this, of course, but what do you make of all the other ET, contactees out there, the messages that comes through various channeling? There is just an endless abundance of this kind of material. Does it all dovetail in a way, or do you feel that it's very restrictive and selected of what who speaks to who here, pretty much? What's your take on it, if you can encapsulate that for us?
Well, I published the books of Philip Kropf. I don't know if you know about his story. He's a contactee. He was an abductee. So I'm pretty conversant with some of the literature. And there are a small minority of transmissions that we have received from extraterrestrial beings within this movement that I mentioned. And what they have told us is that over and over and over again, they've stated, and the Urantia book itself states, that there are many millions of civilizations that are that have the ability to travel space. It doesn't literally state that, but you can easily imply that. And that they do come and they do visit. But if you're a rebellion planet, they're not permitted to. Because the planet's quarantined. Right. So those ETs who have penetrated this planet did it either by special permission or they violated the quarantine. And that's why I've come to believe that some of them are diabolical. I tend to follow those who say that, but I'm a latecomer to that view.
Now briefly, let me ask you this. Do you think that everyone will know about it, though? Is it that organized out there that it's, you know, they keep tabs on everyone, literally?
They being the extraterrestrials?
Yes.
That they have, you know, superior ability to do surveillance and certainly work with, you know, the planetary elites to carry that out. And so in that hypothesis, yeah, they would have supreme access to everything that's going on. And but, you know, I'm of two minds. I mean, I'm sure that there are benign extraterrestrials as well. And so it's a very mixed bag. But I've begun to come to the views of Marshall Summers and people like that, if you know his work, and others who state that there is a dark extraterrestrial presence.
Yeah, definitely. I don't doubt that there's a lot of material about that out there. And we could go on, and I think we should at a later date, Byron, as well, because it's a good time to wrap things up. It's been very interesting, and I want to first of all thank you for your time and for sharing, your insight and interpretation as well of the Urantia book and these updated versions that we talked about. And again, as I said, maybe at a later date we could talk about some of your titles, and one of these, as you mentioned before, is The Adventure of Being Human. But why don't we wrap up giving out your websites again, so our listeners know, basically where to go to find out more from you and your work.
Yeah, thanks. I'd rather just send them to one site. It's, evolving-souls.org. And if you sign up there, I do updates about once a month, and I'm going to start doing teleseminars with special interviews with Urantia experts this year. So you can get in on that. And my publishing website is out of date because I'm just focused on this new stuff. So evolving-souls.org. And if you want to just learn about the sort of the general generic Urantia realm, just plug in the word Urantia and you'll find Urantia.org and Urantiabook.org, and those are the more conventional sites. Just know that my material is more avant-garde, and there is a kind of a mainstream sites that you'll find out there. They're very good, very reliable.
All right, there you go. Excellent. Thank you, Byron. Again, this was a lot of fun, and I hope we can do it at a later time as well.
Thank you so much, Henrik. I loved your questions, and I look forward to working with you some more.
All right, that's it for today's program. Thank you, friends and listeners, for staying with us. We hope you've learned something new or have discovered something that you'd like to know more about. We'll be back in just a few days with Jeremy Riss, the alien scientist, to talk about physics, new technology, aliens, and the 9/11 event, a broad program on lots of different topics. My thanks to Fredrik, Lana, and Elizabeth, and also to you for listening. We'll be back in just a few days. Bye-bye.